This is CliffCentral.com.
Roberta Durant is a creative director and producer and the showrunner of television and film for so many of the things that we've already seen, a longtime working partner of Joe Mafela too at Penguin Films. Shame, I'm sorry about that. I mean, that must have been very, very difficult for you to deal with when he, you know, passed
very sad.
On. Yeah. Very nice
sad.
To meet you though, Roberta.
Thank you. Yeah,
I've probably seen 1,000 of the things that you've produced because you have been in television for a very long time and you've produced some amazing work. Congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm pleased to meet you too. I've never met you.
Well, let's hope by the end of the interview you still feel that way. But I wanted to get you in here because there's so many of these shows that are fascinating to me. And when you are behind the scenes and you're doing the research and when you're directing the productions and when you're putting it all together, what you have to do is to curate the story for the rest of us. And that's often the most difficult part, leaving out some of the things rather than how much. There's always an abundance of material, I'm sure. How much you leave out. And that, to me, is a real skill. It's a talent that very few people possess. It's hard to know what you can cut out and leave on the floor and what you eventually include in the finished product.
Well, particularly with Krotoa, you know, we first made a documentary on her life. And the script was written and researched by Kay Ann Williams, who, you know, wanted to tell the story of Krotoa in this documentary. And once we made the documentary, we realized that there was a narrative feature in her story because she had such a dramatic life. And she had a very intense life over a short period of time at a point in our history which was obviously quite significant with the arrival of Van Riebeek.
Well, let's just start with her since you've brought her up already. And that was one of the things I really did want to discuss with you. Krotoa is the story of a woman who was in the Cape at the Cape of Good Hope when Jan van Riebeek landed there. She became his translator, his interlocutor between the communities that were already living there and these Dutch settlers. And to me, there are so many people who talk about Jan van Riebeek and all they know is 1652. And they have some idea of either, depending on their sense of history, that this was the beginning of Western involvement in South Africa. Certainly it was that. But that it was either good or bad, and they make their decisions from there on. And there's very little interrogation of what actually went on. And this woman, a local indigenous woman, was so crucial to the Dutch understanding of what South Africa was and the South African understanding of what the Dutch people were going to do or bring, that we should really give it more than a casual footnote in the history books. And so far, that is what I think a lot of people kind of pushed Krotoa into.
Well, I mean, there's very little written about her.
Yes.
You know, the history was written by men at that stage. And women didn't really have a voice.
Particularly not indigenous women.
No. And so the point of our film was actually to give her a voice. Mm. So I think, you know, she was taken into East Fort as a young girl. She was 10 or 11 years old, between 10 and 12. And there are various theories about how she landed up there. But anyhow, she became Maria's servant. And he somehow elevated her to an interpreter, translator role, which I think must have been quite extraordinary in the sense that she was a woman. Because, I mean, there were other coy male figures that he could have relied on for this and did actually rely on because he worked a lot with Archimatu, who was her uncle, who's also known as Harry die Strandloper. Mm-hmm. And also with Doman was at some point, you know, he's another a character in the film. Although we've combined certain characters, you know, and created the Doman character. So there were men translating for him, but it's interesting that he, you know, sort of isolated her. And it was because she had been taught Dutch, she could speak fluent French, Portuguese as well, that it, no doubt that happened because she had been assimilated into Dutch culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, groomed by Maria, really, I suppose. And then she married a Danish doctor who was the doctor of the fort, the original fort that Van Riebeek built, which was nothing like the castle. Was a sort of a very basic structure made out of wood and mud and turf that they put together. And she married this Danish doctor, Peter van Mierhoff, who was also an adventurer But anyway, they had three kids. And these kids were eventually taken away from her and brought up by missionaries in Mauritius. And it's interesting because those children, particularly Petronella and Dalian Mateer, wrote a book called Petronella van die Kaap, which was actually Kretowa Eva, as the Dutch named her, daughter. And she married, you know, a Dutch settler family. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting about Kretowa that, in fact, she's in a way a common ancestor.
For so many white Afrikaans people.
Definitely. I mean, Casper de Vries, who I've worked with in the past, you know, he sent me this email. I'm so excited you've been involved in this film. You know, Kretowa was my ninth grandmother and can trace her back. I got another email from a gentleman. He's a farmer, I think, in the Free State. You know, she was his 15th grandmother. So, you know, there is a common ancestor there because of this first recorded by a mixed race marriage. I'm sure there were others, but it's the one that was written down. First.
Well, this is fascinating because I think a lot of people tend to see history in very paltry black and white terms, and particularly South Africa's history, that everything that came before 1994 had to have been horrendously segregated, that there was no means for these cultures to overlap, for them to have shared experiences, for them to have a common history in South Africa, and even a common ancestry. And I think it confuses a lot of people who like that ideological look at what's going on in the world. And they like to box things and to say, well, this is it, and everything before this must have been bad and awful. But here we have a situation where, for so many white Afrikaners, the very embodiment of what many people in this country regard as the patriarchy, here we have a woman who's the common ancestor for so many of those people, and potentially for even many more who don't know that she's their common ancestor, because there were only so many people in the Cape at that time. And there was a lot of talk of slaves being taken in, and they were used as sex slaves or whatever else. But there was also a degree of parity. There was marriage that occurred here. There were very legitimate relationships and very legitimate offspring from some of these unions, which people at that time didn't have a problem with. Many hundreds of years later, obviously were embarrassed about and kept hush-hush, and now are starting to rediscover. That's quite beautiful.
Well, I do think it's interesting. And, you know, there were, when he arrived with 100 men. And I think Maria was there, and then there was another woman. So, I mean, there were no women, but there were 100 men.
So, yeah, out of those 100 men and those two women, we have had a lot of change in South Africa, an entirely new community developed out of that. And many of those descendants are still all over the place. Some of them think of themselves as being white, but they may have some ancestors of color. Some of them think of themselves as black, but they may have ancestors that were white. So we've got to stop this nonsense of looking at everything in very subjective black and white terms, right?
Yeah, and segregated terms.
Yeah, and I think we can't help it because of our history. So tell me what you discovered about the personality of this woman, because she must have been extraordinary. First of all, her huge linguistic abilities, which you've already accounted for, being able to speak French and Portuguese and Dutch, and then obviously, you know, the native Khoi languages as well, and San. But what could she do, and how could she have been better known to us if we'd paid more attention?
Well, I think it's because, you know, we haven't learned those hidden histories. And I think that there is so much of our history that needs to be actually re-examined, because we have had that history recorded from a point of view. So, look, what did I find out about her? I directed the movie. And I produced the documentary, and I directed this movie and co-produced the movie. So what did I find out about her on being presented and having gone into a story that was, you know, devised by Kay Ann Williams? So
sure.
I took that story. And what did I find out? That she must have been a very extraordinary woman because of having this ability with the languages. To find yourself caught between two identities, I think is also extraordinary, because not many of us go through that. And at that stage, there were very separated identities. There was the Khoi community and there was the Dutch community. And they were in stark contrast to one another. And yet she found herself straddled between the two. She found herself straddled between the two.
Right.
So I think, you know, that's intense, and that's an intense life. So, you know, her search for identity and her struggle with identity, I think, was paramount. I also think that in our story, she's a visionary, because we believed, she believed, that there was a middle way between these cultures. And she tried to effect that middle way. What we did know is that she played a role in putting an end to the Khoi-Dutch wars. So that gave us the cue that, yes, she believed there was a middle way between the cultures. But because of her involvement with the Dutch, her own people at a certain point distrusted her.
Oh.
And eventually the Dutch threw her out and abandoned her. And so her life is also very, very tragic. And as somebody who thought there was a middle way right in the beginning of the clash of these two cultures, you know, that to me is quite ironic in a way, because it took many, many years for there to find sort of a middle way.
If we have a middle way now, you can debate whether or not that's happened. But her own people, you say, started to distrust her. So she obviously, upon being thrown out by the Dutch, she had no home. She had nowhere where she felt like she belonged.
Well, that is the point. And, you know, in our story, she became an alcoholic, and she was, in fact, historical fact, imprisoned on Robben Island, where she died. So we had to, when you say, what do you leave out of a story, we had to tell her whole life, because we couldn't actually hone in on one aspect, because it was like a full circle.
How tremendously symbolic that she died on Robben Island.
Absolutely.
For what a portent for what would happen in South Africa so much further down the road. I mean, you could almost say that's epic in its full circle. Does she have a grave?
Do you know that I'm not entirely sure at this point, because I think that her bones were then transported to the castle.
Oh.
And I think she was buried there.
Oh.
And that's where I think she is at the moment. But I think there's been a lot of dialogue about moving her. So, and I, you know, that's what I know factually at the moment.
Is there anyone who can claim to be her most senior descendant who's making these decisions, or are these a sort of arts and culture ministry decision?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it would be fascinating to figure it out. I mean, I didn't invite you here as an expert on Krotoa.
I'm not an expert on the
history. I would love to speak to the researchers in this respect and actually find out more, because I think so little curiosity exists as to these roots of so many of our early ancestors in South Africa, and particularly this overlapping of culture.
Yeah,
look, because it doesn't suit people.
If I may say this, there was lots of irony in what happened to her, because at a certain point after Van Riebeeck left, there was a guy called Wagenaar who became the governor, and he appointed Van Mierhof as the governor of the penal colony of Robben Island.
Mm-hmm.
So they were moved off to Robben Island. And you can imagine at that stage, a lot of her own people were in that prison.
Oh, yeah.
So to be sort of the wife of the governor, you know, where your own people are sitting in the prison, you know, and I think that's where the, you know, the falling apart would have started.
Yeah.
Which, you know, led to her, you know, her destruction in a way.
What do we know about, and how do you represent in a movie or a documentary, the community of Khoi people? Because again, they were written into history by the Dutch, and the Dutch had a certain prejudice towards them. I don't think they had much of an appreciation for what culture and community existed for those people. How do you portray it sensitively?
Well, this was important. And for that, we did have cultural advisors that worked very closely with us, and also language advisors, because we made an effort to speak a language descendant of the language that would have been spoken at that time. And we had a wonderful woman, Dorothea Davids, who actually, you know, had to train the actors in the language, mm-hmm. Which the leads started about 2 months before we started shooting. So, you know,
it's almost like those movies about, you know, the Aramaic spoken in Jesus's time.
Well, in a way, yes.
Kind of a lost.
Yeah, ideally, this film would have been in Dutch and Khoi, but I mean, you know, it's a local film.
Sure.
So, you know, we had to make certain choices around the language that was used in the film.
Did it concern you that there might not be enough interest in this, or were you convinced from the start that this was the sort of story that would resonate very much with South Africans?
You know, one never knows, and especially as a director, I'm working very closely with this, the subject matter. I mean, daily and hours of putting it together. So one doesn't know how a film ever is received. So, what I do think is appealing, I think it's appealing to young people. And I say that because everybody in the film is young, except for one character or two characters. Which was Wagenaar, who was the governor who took over, and Van Riebeek's right hand, Van Roelof, who's played by Dion Lotz. But, you know, when Van Riebeek was here, he arrived here, he was 27, 28. Mm. So these people were all young. They weren't stuffy. They were young. And they were people. I think we mustn't forget that they were people. You know, we see a picture of Van Riebeek with that sort of poofed up wig. And he looks ancient.
And the lace collar, yeah.
And he looks old, you know. But he wasn't old when he was here.
Do you have to do quite a lot of work when it comes to costume, set, that kind of thing, because you can choose to represent history in an almost comical, ridiculous way if you want to. But if you have a care for these things, and particularly I think the audience that would want to see this would be an audience that would be interested in seeing a fairly accurate portrayal of what it looked like, felt like, smelt like, sounded like at that time.
We made a very definite effort to do that, particularly in how we went about, you know, creating that fort and building the fort. And we were very true to the facts there.
Mm.
And also the Khoi villages and the costumes. We did a lot of research into the wardrobe, etc., for that very reason. And we made choices around it as well. Because, you know, I wanted to contrast the sort of... because if you look at the forts that the Dutch built, they didn't only build a fort here, by the way. They built the similar forts in a number of different countries because the Dutch were explorers.
Right. East Indies and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So you know, it was a very dark structure because it was dark. It was a sort of black, muddy, dark.
Well, it was part military, part trading post. It wasn't glamorous and beautiful and made of stone and a historical building that they were going to leave there forever. For them, it was a temporary dwelling, really.
It was a temporary dwelling. Later on, 10 years later, they built the castle, 10 years after they were here.
A lot of people don't know, and I discovered this the other day, Van Riebeek never intended to create a permanent settlement here.
No, when he first arrived here, he had the directive that he had to have a good relationship, working relationship with the local tribes because they were reliant on them.
Hmm.
They were reliant
resources,
on
resources, water,
food,
yeah.
You know, for cattle, for stocking up the ships that were going around. That was their instruction, and they didn't enslave them then.
Hmm.
They actually brought their slaves with them from Madagascar. And this is, in fact, when her husband died, he was on supposedly a slave catching mission in Madagascar. He was killed in an ambush. So they imported their slaves at that point. They didn't enslave. But the enslavement
South Africa doesn't actually have a slave tradition per se, like the West of Africa does and like Madagascar did or the Arab world does. By numbers, certainly nowhere near.
Well, you know, I think that it did happen later.
Mm.
You know, it might not have happened at that point. But I think the turning point was the decision to settle. And the decision to settle was a huge turning point because it became a land issue.
Mm.
Because then it was settling on the land. And in a way, we have to say taking the land.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, there are metaphors in the film, and hopefully, you know, people see the metaphors of taking and being attracted by and taking. So, you know, the movie is layered and it has metaphors in it, and hopefully people don't take it all too literally, you know.
Is that part of the fun of creating a show like this, a movie, putting together a production, is that you can put in those layers?
Yes, I mean, that's the point.
It's like writing a good book, right? You kind of have almost an underlying story beneath the story.
Yes, and visual layers, you know, and symbols and iconology and all of that. That makes it interesting.
Do you have to be politically sensitive and aware to put this together? And how much of that influences the way that you create the feeling of history? Because there may be things that are uncomfortable, politically incorrect things that you have to treat differently. in the composition of something like this, just so that you don't piss off everybody who sees it now?
Well, I think if you speak to Kay, the writer, about what the intention was in terms of, because she created the story, was to stimulate debate, primarily to stimulate debate, and to open up these areas for debate and to get people thinking about these issues. And, you know, maybe it throws a cat amongst the pigeons, but, you know, you'll get extreme reactions on either side, and you will get those reactions.
Yeah.
It's you know.
It's almost, but you want it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, depend. I mean, we want a healthy dialogue. That's what you want. That's what the intention is.
Well, in the social media universe of 2017, there's no such thing as a healthy dialogue. There's just unhealthy screaming and shouting. So you're prepared for that as well, obviously.
Well, there'll be a lot of noise. But people who have seen it, we've had very positive reaction. And you know, hopefully it moves people. It may make them angry, but hopefully there is a reaction.
Yes.
And hopefully it triggers a whole lot more films about women, because I think that there are a lot of women in our history that could have films made about them. And hopefully this isn't even the first film on Krakatoa. Maybe, you know, somebody else makes a different film on Krakatoa. And to see history is not something that's dull and dreary and, you know, and not entertainment in a way. You know, and I know entertainment might sound odd, but, you know, you go into a movie theater for a reason. So hopefully many more films are made around this subject matter, and that people are, you know, brave enough to open up these debates and to, you know, to put it out there and to have an interpretation, because not everybody will have the same interpretation. And because a lot of the facts about her life, they're facts, there's written down facts, then there's lots of deductions, there's lots of speculations, there's oral tradition, there's a lot of different interpretations. So I think that it's healthy. Of course, one is sensitive, but at the same time, you know, you make a film.
What do we know about the Dutch who landed at the Cape? What kind of people were they? I mean, again, we tend to stereotype just like we do with the Khoi, and just like we might have with someone like Krakatoa. What do we know about them?
Well, there's quite a lot written. I mean, in terms of Van Riebeck's diary, because he wrote this extensive diary, and he wrote some of it. He had a lot of scribes writing as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of the diary is all about their struggles, because, you know, they weren't used to the germs here, so a lot of, you know, they died off. And they had to bring more boats with more Dutch, because the original 100, I think there were 10 of them left or something like
that. Wow.
Which is why they needed Dr. Van Meerhof, you know, because they weren't used to our germs. And vice versa, the Dutch bought in a lot of germs, or the Europeans bought in a lot of germs.
Which the local population suffered from.
Suffered from, yeah. So a lot of the diaries are about that. But there, you can see sort of elements of a kind of a humorous person there somewhere.
Oh.
But quite also a clearly prejudiced person. Mm. There was a prejudice.
Yes, but I, this is where I think people tend to, again, be very myopic about history. Like, of course they were prejudiced. They arrived in a foreign land where everything was strange. And similarly for the Khoi, these strange people getting off of these ships, prejudice is inevitable in that situation. If you are not prejudiced and you're naive, you get enslaved, killed, or worse, which we know from South America, North American history, even Australia, the Aborigines. So it's almost a survival instinct to be very, let's call it cynical, about any kind of foreignness in people. And whether that came from the Dutch or from the Khoi, naturally you would expect that sort of behavior from them, especially in the beginning.
Yeah, I suppose it's also about that whole story of survival. Mm. You know, if you this book, what's it, The 100 Years of Something, that goes back in history. What's that wonderful book? I've forgotten the title now. In terms of how we got to where we are.
Mm.
You know? But I do think that what's very nice about, well, when I say very nice, what I think is positive about telling these type of stories is that we do look back into the past and we celebrate and give a voice, particularly to women. I think that's important. But also an honoring of those people that came before us, because they had a very tough life.
Mm-hmm.
Our ancestors had a tough time of it.
Yeah.
I mean, our lives are easy. We have tough issues in another way,
best,
maybe.
It's the best time to be alive. This is my ongoing mantra. And whenever people say to me, oh, it's so difficult in South Africa now, or it's so difficult if you are in rural KwaZulu-Natal, anywhere you are in the world right now, you're better off than any ancestor of yours ever was, no matter how rich and privileged they might have in their time been. You have flushing lavatories, you have electricity, we have cell phones, we have Google. There's lots of, it makes life a lot easier. I think a lot of people would be fascinated to know, when you create, when you craft something like this that has a historical element to it, how much detail you get to focus on. Because again, there are budgetary constraints. There are all kinds of things that come into this. And in South Africa, we don't have tons of money for making movies.
We had a very small budget to make this movie. It was supported by the National Film and Video Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
It was supported by the Department of Trade and Industry.
Uh-huh.
And it was supported by CakeNet, as in Mnet.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you to them, because if we don't have people like that supporting the kind of work that you're doing, we're just never going to know more about our history. And believe me, the people who are going to read that stuff and do the research that your researchers did are not going to do it in their droves. They might go and see this movie in their droves.
Mm. Well, that's the thing. And you know, hats off that they actually, you know, saw the value in the script and decided to support the project. And because then otherwise it wouldn't be made.
Right.
And the thing is that we made it on a very small budget, which was a very big, huge challenge because of what, you know, we wanted to do with it. But at the same time, because of that, we had to keep it sort of confined to her story. But anyhow, we built this fort and we were very specific about giving it a sort of very basic, sort of rough texture, because I think it was very rough. They arrived with a few bits of furniture. They had to rely on, you know, what they found here. They bought their food. And in fact, in that first fort, they put all their supplies under where they lived. They dug big holes and put the flour and the sugar and those basic things, rice, I guess, and buried it there. And then they grew vegetables. Van Riebeeck was a great vegetable grower. He liked growing things.
Hence Tuina.
Excuse?
Tuina.
Hence
gardens. That was where he grew all the crops.
Hence. So he was that. And then they had the cattle. You know, they were reliant on the Khoi tribes to get hold of the cattle. And that's where the bartering came in. But I mean, it is shocking when you look at what was bartered, because, you know,
what did they give to, what did you get for a cow if you were a Khoi herder?
A pipe from India, a bottle of brandy.
Wow.
Some copper wiring. Oh, that's the fact.
It's so, not a fair trade.
It was not
by today's standards. Although I suppose for someone who didn't have a pipe would be quite a useful thing.
Well, have you never seen such a decorative pipe?
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, they knew what they must have known what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, we also assume, and sometimes in a prejudiced way, that these Khoi herders were somehow simple folk in every sense. They probably wanted certain things for whatever purpose and reason, and maybe decorative was something that they aspired to at that point.
Yeah.
We can't go back and use 2017 eyes to figure out whether or not something was a fair trade. If they didn't think so, they wouldn't have given a cow for that stuff. Perhaps for them, cows were one thing that they had in abundance.
Well,
who knows?
This is true.
I mean, ultimately, someone takes advantage of someone in every trade.
Yes. Well, you can see it like that, I guess.
What do you feel, I mean, for how many other, you said there are lots of stories about women, what do you feel for you is the most meaningful part of this? Having had such a successful career, and you continue to have an amazing career in television, with so many shows that we've watched, I could go through the list and people will know all about it. Squid is Nice, Going Up About Us, Madam and Eve, SOS, Mazinho, Stockfell. I mean, these are all really, really well-known shows. Home Affairs, right? 65 one-hour episodes. I mean, that's massive success in this environment.
I'm busy with 208 episodes now.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. That's really, that's quite something. And then, of course, your films. Inside Out, Skillpoppa and Felix. And there's a bit of a resurgence in Afrikaans film in South Africa. We've got to say that that seems to be an area where there's been suddenly quite tremendous success. And that, I suppose, must invigorate you.
Well, look, the success in Afrikaans language films is really due to CakeNet's support.
Mm.
I myself am not Afrikaans speaking, although I would say I'm nearly bilingual. But I think without CakeNet support, these films would not be made.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully Mnet and CakeNet continue to support film, because without their contribution, it's difficult to fund, because, you know, you cannot make a movie just with the NFEF or the KZN Film Commission and the DTI. You need to have some other money to just make it possible. And, you know, then you're sort of basically covering your costs. So, the fact that they have been supporters of local film is why you have these films. And that's why you don't only have Afrikaans films, but, you know, local South African films.
Well, the reason I brought all that up and I went into your CV was because I'm wondering what's next. To do a movie like this clearly is meaningful for you, and there are so many women's stories in South Africa that you've already indicated you would love to tell. And what's next on the menu for you? Because while you're producing all this TV stuff, which is clearly, you know, it's the bread and butter for you, but it's something you love, there must be things that you still want to tick off.
Well, I haven't since Kritto, because, these films are all consuming. They take hours and hours of your time and years of your time, really. I haven't actually thought beyond Kritto, because I've got involved in the TV projects. I actually haven't. We're doing another TV project for CakeNet called Sara Sahaim at the moment.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as we're going into a second season of that. So the thing is that I haven't thought beyond that. And with feature films, it has to be something for me that's quite unusual and extraordinary, because the amount of effort that you have to put into just making it happen is so enormous, and that it can't just be anything. So, and all the films that I have made, have been very specific. There's been a reason why I've decided, okay, I'm going to put my efforts behind this one, because it is a journey. It really is a journey to pull it together. So I haven't actually thought beyond this film.
Well, I don't doubt there'll be more. From you.
Someone asks me to direct another movie and I don't.
Well, you're very prolific. I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming out. So, and I think that it's important that people who have experience like you have can cast an eye over these things, because I think it's hard to tell whether something will be successful or whether it'll end up as a good final product unless you've got the experience you've got. Is it easy for you now?
No. Not really. And quite frankly, I had no idea how Kritto would be received, because when you've worked so closely with something for so long, and it's the music, and it's the grade, and it's this, and it's that, I honestly, you lose all perspective.
Are you nervous about its reception?
Not really. It'll be what it'll be. I'm not really nervous. It's done. There was, films are not made by one person.
Mm.
Films are made by a team of people. So, it's done. We all put our efforts behind it, 100%. I had wonderful actors. They invested in this 200%. Crystal Donna Roberts is marvelous as Kritoa. That I know in terms of the performances. And I think that's why it's won its awards internationally. And we made a very conscious effort to test the water with this film internationally, because we found with Felix, my last film, sort of came and went here locally and then went and won 17 awards internationally. And all of a sudden, everyone is saying, where's this film, Felix? And so I'm glad we did test the waters with it internationally first, and where it went, we chose the festivals quite carefully, and where it went, it was, it won its accolades. So, from that, I know it's a good film. It's well crafted. That I know. But how people will receive the story and the content, I think it's going to be very, very mixed, very diverse. I think, you're going to get all sorts of reactions.
So Crystal Donna Roberts, who else is in it?
Armand Oekamp plays mm-hmm. Van Riebeek, and Jacques Bessinger plays Van Mierhoff. That was a difficult part, the most difficult part to cast for me, because he was this gentle doctor on the one hand in our story. Whether he was really like that, we don't know. And on the other hand, he was this adventurer, because it is recorded that he tried to tame zebras unsuccessfully.
Must have been kicked a lot in the head.
Yeah. Well, it kicked his cockabian. Yeah. And then Dion Lotz plays Van Roelof. Wagenaar is played by Marcel van Heerden. And Oucha Matu is played by Brendan Daniels. And then Ernest St. Clair interprets the role of Doman. And then there are obviously other smaller parts.
Is it very difficult to cast these things? Or is it easy because, either in spite of or because of, the fact that we have such a small community of actors and professionals in feature film in South Africa? Are you confident when you go into it, oh, this will be easy, I already have an idea of who I might want for these roles? Or is it the opposite, that you have to be very thorough and careful and consider all the options before you make a decision?
We auditioned everybody.
Really?
We saw a lot of people. We saw all the potential possibilities. Funnily enough, Crystal was about the eighth person I saw.
Yes.
And she stood out immediately. And the challenge for her was that she had to play this young, innocent girl, and then she had to play the 30-year-old, you know, the end of her life. So, you know, she had to have that range. And I could see that she would do that and have the emotional depth. That was very clear on her audition. So after I saw her, I thought she was our Crotone. Then I saw a whole lot of other people, but I went back to her. And then, as I say, Jacques was the most difficult. Armand came, he was clearly the best option for Van Riebeek, and Dion Lotz was obviously the best option for Van Roelof. So, you know, these things kind of hit you when you audition, but we auditioned a lot of people. I saw a lot of little girls to play the little Krotoa.
Oh, yeah.
And then, funnily enough, the little girl that eventually interpreted Clarice Williams, she stood out to me for one reason. When I went in between seeing all these young girls, and they were ranged between 11 and 9, I went to have a bathroom break. And when I went outside, this little girl was in the passage, and she was having a huge argument with her whoever it was, uncle or whoever had accompanied her to this audition, because she didn't like what he was trying to do with her hair. So she eventually said, "Nia," you know, and came into the bathroom sort of in front of me and went into the bathroom, and I watched her, and she with great determination took her hair and divided it up into three ponytails.
And you thought, this is the
and
girl.
I thought to myself, here's a spirited somebody. And so she came in, and she I could see this immediately. This was the little girl. And funny enough, because she was so determined. And when she, after the first day of shooting, she told me, "Ek wil huis toe gaan." She didn't like it. She wanted to go home.
So, she really is like,
because she was, you know, she wasn't. She was spirited. So anyhow, we got over that, thank goodness. And then after that, she just loved it. So she absolutely loved it and was, you know, very sad when the end came and so on. But I love working with children. It's very rewarding working with children because they are what they are, and they're honest, and when they're acting, they play. You know, they're like in the moment completely. If they are good actors, that's what they do. They're in the moment and they play, and it's just wonderful, very rewarding.
I wish you the best of luck. It starts on the 4th of August, it's being released.
Yes, tomorrow.
Yes, so that's quite a big deal. And I encourage everybody to go and see this. If you care about the history of South Africa, and you're not just one of those political ideologues who throws around 1652 like it's a weapon, there are stories of real people. And Krotoa is one of those people who probably history has ignored for far too long. Yeah. You didn't think of dressing Casper de Vriesap as Krotoa?
Well, I didn't know about it till afterwards. But I'm not sure I would have done that.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Roberta
you.
Durant, what an interesting discussion. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.